This is Bob Inyart inviting you to read our manuscript, The Plot, for an overview of the whole Bible. Call us at 800-836-9278. That's 836-9278.
Warning, warning, there's truth up ahead. It gets beyond all the headlines you read. Don't need lip service with a wink and a nod. You need a man on a mission from God. Well, not to worry, here's Bob Inyart.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to another episode of Real Science Friday. I'm Bob Inyart.
And I'm Fred Williams, software engineer and creation speaker.
Fred, bees, pollen, brains, and turtles.
And they outsmart computers. Bees with that little pea-sized, not even pea-sized, pinhead-sized brain.
A pinhead-sized brain in a bee. So these four things, what they have in common is they're all in the current edition of Creation Magazine from CMI, Creation Ministries International. So can you introduce us to the first of these four topics for today's show? Bees, pollen, brains, and turtles, sea turtles. How about bees?
Well, you know, one of the most difficult mathematical computations is a problem called the traveling salesman problem.
Oh, yeah. The least distance problem, right?
The least distance. Given a list of locations and the distances between them, it involves finding the shortest possible route in which each location is visited once.
Yeah. So if you give to a computer, like a salesman that has to go to 50 cities or 80 or 100, how long might it take a supercomputer to solve that problem?
Yeah, to calculate the shortest route for him to achieve that.
Right.
And it gets far more complex the more cities you add.
Right.
I mean, I believe it's exponential.
Well, so how long might it take? This is according to the University of London, and this news has gone throughout the science world, and scientists are stunned.
Well, this traveling salesman problem takes supercomputers with, like, say, 100 cities, days to compute the correct result.
And a supercomputer costs typically millions of dollars, and it's very hard to get time on it.
That's right.
So imagine it takes days. Here's the University of London and a professor, Lars Chitka, who has done this study. They were really pretty brilliant. They thought, let's try honeybees. Let's see how they handle this problem. So they had flowers appear for these honeybees, and they videotaped them to track them to see. And the flowers would come and go. They'd add flowers in the middle of the problem. They'd add more flowers. And they didn't do this with 30 or 40 flowers, did they?
No. Over 100. Hundreds of flowers.
They used hundreds of flowers, and these honeybees solved the problem effortlessly.
They solved the problem. Where did they get that knowledge? Do you think they come out of their honeycomb and they go to bee school and they take advanced calculus 3?
They must.
Differential equations?
When a honeybee first flies out of the hive, even the first time ever, he flies up and he surveys the land. And, you know, it's a three-dimensional landscape with hills and streams and people's backyards and garages in the way and all. Surveys the landscape, then they sit down and they get out their clay tablets and they start doing mathematical equations. And they work on it for hours, right? No, they don't. They just take a look, then they start, and scientists are astounded that these bees find the most efficient path, the least distance, to get to hundreds of flowers, even when they introduce new flowers in the middle of the problem.
Yeah. You know, I'm a software engineer, Bob, and, you know, we can't get this right. It takes us days just to get really a handful of these locations, right? I mean, what does this say about the designer of the bee?
Oh, wow. So God, it's not that the bee has to solve this. It's called the traveling salesman problem or the least distance problem. It's not that the bee has to solve that problem to survive. He could just keep going to the closest flower that he sees. Where's the next one? Where's the next one? But they don't. They route themselves so the overall trip is the least distance. But God put this ability in them because he enjoys it.
Yeah, and the programming has to be there from the beginning. This, again, we're being facetious. They can't just learn this stuff. This information comes from the beginning. You know, Bob, I sure wish we had this. I mean, I don't know if you're like me. when I go to somewhere repetitive like work or somewhere else, I want to find the shortest distance. That's just the way I am. And oftentimes I'm frustrated. I remember one time many years ago I was in a band. And had a roommate, and I drove what was the most optimum route to practice. I know I had because I had figured it out in my mind. Well, he beat me home one day, and he just went straight up Sheridan. I'm like, how did that happen? I was wrong.
Right. So the scientists are thinking, like the co-author of the study, Dr. Matthew Lahoro, he's saying these bees, they have a brain the size of a pinhead, yet they have this advanced cognitive capacity. If we could figure out how a bee does it with such minimal hardware, the neurons in the bee's brain, imagine what we can do. Our own computing technology could become tremendously advanced if we could solve these problems effortlessly.
Oh, yeah.
And quickly.
Yeah. It would be nice, you know, because I know a lot of times when I put directions on Google Map, they show you the fastest way to get there.
Yeah.
And a lot of times it's not.
Right. Hey, Fred, how about pollen? Because bees, ultimately, they're after pollen. You know, it's amazing that a bee could fly in the first place. But the aerodynamics, it's just so stunning.
Yeah, I think we've talked about that on another show.
And how well they fly. But they're going after pollen. And pollen is interesting because to have pollen, you need plants, trees, and flowers that produce pollen. So you're not going to have pollen before you have plants. Well, the evolutionist world, they don't think when life started to evolve on Earth, they think, you know, a couple billion years ago, they don't think that plants showed up right away. They think hundreds of millions of years passed before there was anything like a plant. First, there were just single-celled creatures for hundreds of millions of years.
Yeah, so the problem is they're finding pollen in rock layers that they believe are, what?
1.8. Billion years old. 1.7, 1.8 billion years old, and they think pollen only showed up maybe 400 million years ago. So you have pollen that is fossilized in Precambrian rock, the lowest rock on Earth, sedimentary rock. This is metamorphic rock. The lowest rock on Earth, in different countries they find this. How does pollen show up? 1,000, let's be generous to the evolutionist, 1,300 million years before a plant showed up. 1,300 million, 1.3 billion years before plants evolved, you've got pollen at the very bottom of the geologic column, at the bottom.
Well, I like what the scientist who reported this in Nature said. His conclusion was, "We offer no solution to the paradox." And he called it a highly intriguing geologic problem.
Yeah.
Well, for us, it's not a problem.
No, it's not a problem because God made trees in the first 6 days of creation. He made trees along with animals and birds and sea creatures and then man on the sixth day. So it's not a problem at all. It's more an expectation that when we look at the fossil record, we're going to find things out of order of what the evolutionists say. And Fred, Nature magazine has known about this problem for a half a century.
Yep.
Early on, when it was first reported widely around the world, it caused quite a stir. The argument against it was they said, well, this is metamorphic rock. Metamorphic rock undergoes pressure and heat, and it changes, like, say, from limestone to marble. So they said, well, nobody's done the research, and really pollen couldn't withstand that change. Well, in 2007, in the French Alps, there's a study published in a scientific journal. And Fred, this journal, Earth Science Letters, they report that they have remarkably well-preserved fossil pollen in metamorphic rock. And this is rock that has undergone high-grade metamorphism. So now that argument that, well, metamorphic rock couldn't possibly have pollen. So this fossil pollen, it's really something else. That argument is now shot.
It's gone. It's gone away.
Right.
So the solution is, I would present to the audience, a global flood that buried mud all around the world. And in some cases, pollen's going to get buried in some layers of rock.
Right, exactly. So the rules of the game, they point out in creation.com, the rules of the game, if evolution were not true, you would find fossils in strata earlier than these things evolved. Here we find it 1.3 3 billion years before plants evolved, we find pollen.
So how do you falsify evolution?
You find fossils before they're supposedly evolved.
That's right.
This happens all the time.
It does.
With things that are found before they
evolved.
We've
reported many out-of-place fossils on this show.
And didn't creationists go to the Grand Canyon to look for pollen?
Yeah, that's right. Creation Research Society, they had studies in the, I believe it was the late 60s, and they found pollen in the Grand Canyon pre-Cambrian strata, this first layer of rocks that you just talked about.
Wow.
What is pollen doing there?
Fred, bees use their little bug brains, and they go out and they find pollen in the most efficient imaginable way because God created them in his brilliance. And so we have a human brain. Our brain has way more capacity and abilities than a bee's brain. And Creation Magazine reports on new findings of really how sophisticated our brains are.
Oh, it's staggering. There are 125 trillion synapses.
Well, wait a minute. You and I, earlier today, we talked to a neat guy, Andres, and we asked him, he's an evolutionist and an atheist. We said, how many synapses in your brain, one human brain? He said, millions.
And we said, no, go higher.
He said, billions. Thumbs up. He said, trillions? Trillions, 125 trillion synapses. But Fred, then what does each one of those, what do they do? How do they function?
Well, what's amazing is they function like a microprocessor. Each of these 125
trillion
microprocessors, they each have about 1,000 molecular switches of their own.
Whoa.
1,000 molecular switches in one single synapses, and they're going to talk to 125 trillion other synapses. Now, as a firmware or software engineer...
Yeah, this is, we're speaking your language, right?
We are. We are speaking my language.
You're a firmware engineer.
Yeah, so it's software at the hardware level. So we interact directly with the hardware.
Software is what you download from the internet, like an app.
Yeah, an application.
But firmware, that's the...
Programming language is directly talking to the hardware. Mm-hmm. So we're talking to the CPU, the microcontroller.
Right.
So I've been in a lot of projects over my career. We've had a few multiprocessor systems. We've had some that as many as six. Mm-hmm. But typically we'll have like a two-processor system. Mm. And the complexity just for those two processors to talk to each other to provide either co-functionality or redundancy is remarkable. The complexity is amazing.
The overhead goes up significantly.
Yeah, it does significantly.
And the complexity goes up significantly. So Fred,
and we're talking
forget
two.
About two microprocessors. Forget about six or maybe a supercomputer that has 4,000 microprocessors in massive parallel processors. Forget about that. We've got in a child's brain, average human brain, 125 trillion microprocessors.
Almost equal to the national debt.
Don't tell Obama what comes after a trillion. Each one of these has 1,000 molecular switches. So that means we have 125 quadrillion switches. In your brain, that's a lot more than a bee has, and look what a bee can do.
So this scientist from Stanford, he equated it to a single human brain has more switches than all the computers and routers and internet connections on Earth.
On Earth.
On Earth.
On Earth.
A single human brain.
So our brain has more switches, and a switch, like in a microprocessor, there are switches. For example, they might go on or off to indicate the state, like you're doing a subtraction or a multiplication and you're carrying a 10. Let's say there's a switch that just keeps track of whether you're carrying a 1 or not.
Yeah.
Right? What do switches do? They do all kinds of things that hold Boolean states, true or false. So here, your brain has 125 quadrillion switches.
And I like another analogy he offers is that these synapses would, if you equated them to stars, it would fill 1,500 Milky Way galaxies. And just imagine the number of stars in a
the
galaxy.
The Milky Way is enormous.
Enormous. So 1,500 of those.
1,500 Milky Way galaxies, that many stars, that's how many synapses you have just in your cerebral cortex, not in your whole brain, but the part of the brain that we like to talk about a lot because of its memory and all its capabilities.
So they live in this bipolarism. The other side of his brain is going to say this all happened by chance.
Right.
So how do they live in this world? Wow. They describe this amazingly complex thing, and yet they'll turn around and tell their students, oh, yeah, evolution is true.
All right.
Random mistakes in natural selection made this happen.
All right. So, Fred, we're talking about the glory of God as the creator and what we learn from studying his creation. And Charles Darwin pulled a fast one on the atheist. I think he really duped them. Because, Fred, I don't think our godless governments over the last 150 years, I don't think they would have spent a combined trillions of dollars to study the creation if they realized that what they were doing was showing the glory of God. I don't think they would have done it. If they recognized God as the creator, I don't think we would have our government spending billions of dollars right and left to study the creation. But it's because they think that they're acting out evidence against God in their rebellion. It's because of that they are filling the world with evidence of the hand of God as the creator.
That's right. It's backfiring on them.
I think it's backfiring big time. So turtles.
Turtles, yeah.
Sea turtles. I want to keep score on this one. So let's think about the brain of a sea turtle.
Okay.
Let's talk all about these sea turtles. They're so cool. They get real big. When they hatch, they're a little two-inch thing.
And the one we're going to talk about is called a loggerhead, so it sounds kind of like a dumb turtle, right?
Loggerhead.
He's a loggerhead.
Loggerhead. They're at loggerheads with Charles Darwin. That's who they're at loggerheads with. So I want to keep score when we go through this, and I want to start out with turtles zero and Darwin zero.
Okay.
And see where we get. First of all, could you tell us something about the sea turtle? What is a sea turtle and what does it do?
Well, it just sits on the road and gets run over by cars.
That's not a sea turtle. Yeah. Sea turtles get run over by boats.
Yeah.
Actually, they live for decades and they only spend a couple months of their life on land.
Yep.
And that's when they're underground, buried inside of eggs, right?
That's right. But yet they can migrate up to 9,000 miles through the ocean.
As in their migratory
patterns.
So these turtles, when they hatch, they're about 2 inches long. The pregnant female, she lays her eggs in what they call clutches a few times in a mating season, which is once every few years, which is how they would have survived the global flood. She crawls onto the beach and digs a hole in the sand and lays about 100, 150 eggs. And then she's gone. And they're getting ready. They're maturing. When they hatch, they begin to climb up toward the surface of the sand, but they don't stick their heads up because they'd get picked off by birds or raccoons or foxes or people. So they stay just under the surface of the beach and they wait till the sand gets cool because that's nighttime. And then they pop their heads out and they scurry, dozens, scores of them, they scurry into the sea.
Wow.
And a lot of them get picked off, but the mother lays so many eggs, they survive. Like God said, they fill the earth with life. Then they begin to travel from, let's say, Florida to Africa through the ocean, or from Japan to California.
So how do they know how to get where they're going?
How do they know? All right, so that's first issue, turtle zero, Darwin zero.
Okay.
Let's figure that out. How do they know to get where they're going and then back? Because many of them come back to the same beach they hatched on when they were just 2 inches long and little infant turtles setting out for the first time. How do they get back to the same beach? How do they do it?
So they know about the magnetic field.
Oh.
Do they use the magnetic field? Do they have a compass?
Well, they must have a built-in compass.
A built-in compass. So they can detect longitude, right? What about latitude?
Well, a compass. Wasn't there a famous evolutionist who said that evolution could never develop a magnet or a wheel? Wasn't
it? Yeah, J.B.S. Haldane.
That's the guy who came
up with Haldane's dilemma. That's another issue.
Yeah.
But yeah, he said that various mechanisms such as the wheel and magnet, which would be useless till fairly perfect.
So evolution, if it were true, it couldn't invent a magnet. Because that would have to happen over many generations, a little bit at a time, and it wouldn't really help you survive as a creature unless it functioned pretty well. So it's useless. Gradual changes couldn't create a wheel, because the wheel is not going to help until it functions. So a turtle actually has the ability to sense a magnetic field?
That's right. What has astonished researchers...
I'd say that's turtles 1, Darwin 0.
Turtles 1, nothing.
1, nothing.
What has astonished researchers is their ability to also detect latitude.
Now, wait.
Why is that so hard?
Now, wait. My son, Zachary, who just went to Boundary Waters and he canoed for 75 miles, he needed a good compass.
A very good compass.
We got him a good compass. We did the research. It was expensive. And it's a good compass. And finally, in my life, I can play with a compass that actually works. And it really works. But Fred, it points north because that's where the magnetic field is stronger. Mm-hmm. And so the other way is south. And then we figure out east and west. Because of that, you could figure out latitude. Let's say you're going in a certain direction and the magnetic field is getting stronger. You're going north, or if it's getting weaker, you're going south. So we understand latitude, but the scientists are telling us that sea turtles can know where they are longitudinally, east and west, on the globe? Come on. That's not possible with a magnetic field.
You need to detect the angle of the magnetic pole to be able to determine east and west. Was your son able to determine that?
Fred,
does he have an angleometer?
This is unbelievable. We don't do this. Scientists are saying now that we realize that sea turtles can navigate not only latitude but longitude so that literally they know where they are on the globe. They know where they are, which is astounding. He said, now that we know that, maybe we can do it too if we try.
Yeah. Took us hundreds of years, human navigators, to figure out the longitude. And they were paid a huge sum of money, whoever'd come up with it.
To do that.
Yeah, some guy named John Harrison.
The British Crown offered this $3 million reward way back in the 1700s or something.
And someone finally collected on it. He figured out how to determine longitude. It took hundreds of years.
So sea turtles do it effortlessly. So I'd say that's turtles 2, Darwin 0.
Yeah. So they can find an exact GPS point on a map. So when you put in Latin long on your Google map,
right,
you know, you have to do that through a computer. They've got that in their brain.
A sea turtle could do it over thousands of miles in the ocean where there are not a lot of landmarks.
If God would have given us this to humans, we would not have needed GPS things in our car.
We wouldn't need GPS. Imagine not needing GPS because
OnStar would be out of business.
Because it's instant.
That's right.
It's automatic. There are no landmarks in the ocean by definition, right? No landmarks, except when a turtle leaves Japan to go to California, it might pass Maui.
Okay.
But other than that, there are no landmarks, so the turtles know where they're going. Now, the way they proved this was brilliant. They took these pools and they set up computer-controlled magnets around the pools, and they programmed the computers to trick the turtle into thinking that they were points along the turtle's route heading from the Americas, from Florida, over to Europe. And these were turtles that were just hatched, brand new turtles, living in these pools. And they said, now, if the turtles could really sense this angle of the magnetic field, they're going to swim to the northeast. And these other turtles, they're going to swim to the northwest. And that's exactly what happened.
Oh, it's amazing.
Brilliant.
And you know what else this article points out is they found one of these turtles in rock layers that are 200 million years old.
200 million years old. And how much have turtles changed in the fossil record? Turtles are turtles.
They're still turtles.
And Fred, evolution says change, but stasis says they stay the same. So I'd say that's another point for the turtles.
That is. That's 3-0.
3-0, because turtles in the fossil record are only turtles. And the evolutionists, they argue, they say, you know, we think turtles evolved from maybe lizards or maybe snakes. Well, now they do this molecular testing, and they say, you know what? Turtles are not really close to snakes. They're closer to birds or crocodiles. So the molecular testing doesn't match their morphological assumptions. I'd say that's another point for turtles. I'd say that's 4 for the turtles and 0 for the evolutionist.
Well, you know, the authors of this paper, of this newly discovered turtle in the fossil record, he said that it produced more questions than it answers, reopening questions of turtle origins, shell evolution, and original paleontology. So another out-of-place fossil, right?
Another out-of-place fossil. Then you have turtles, like all creatures, have all multicellular creatures, have that ATP synthase.
Uh-oh, are we getting to the wheel?
They've got wheels, right? They're like rotary motors. So if a turtle can't have a magnet, if it evolved, and it does, and it can't have a wheel, which it does, along with everything else, you know, not amoebas, but all multicellular creatures have ATP synthase. We did a whole show on this, how sophisticated they are to produce little energy packets. So I'd say it's turtles 5, Darwin 0.
Wow.
I like it.
Well, you know, something else I wanted to bring up, Bob, there's a study, I don't know, a couple of years ago about these leatherback turtles, and they find that they use the ocean currents, these underwater currents, to get from one place to another. They take advantage of these
undersea
pathways to get from one place to the other. Is there
that sounds biblical.
It does. Is there any mention of that in the Bible?
I have to recall, but is it the book of Job?
It is the book of Job.
Yeah. And the oldest book in the Bible.
It talks about the springs in the sea.
The springs, and it depends on your translation, but you look at the Hebrew, and it looks like the channels.
Yeah.
Or the rivers that are in the sea.
That's right.
And it wasn't until modern navigation of the oceans that these channels were documented, those that are on the surface.
Did you see the movie Nemo?
Finding Nemo.
Finding Nemo.
Yes.
Okay, do you remember that scene where turtles jump into that little
That sea
channel?
Turtle, his name was Crunch? Crush.
But they were using those underwater ocean sea currents to get from one place to another.
Oh, yeah.
Again, this is mentioned in the Bible long before these channels were even discovered.
And didn't they discover a river at the bottom of the ocean?
So they recently discovered, last year, they discovered a river that's about 115 feet deep, and it has rapids and waterfalls, and it's a river deep on the bottom of the ocean.
And that's possible because of the different densities of water.
Yeah. And absolutely,
the different densities flow. And we talked about blue whales and how they take advantage of the density of the water, and they get right in the right spot, and they could talk back and forth over 2,000 miles. God is amazing. God is amazing, and the world is filled with evidence for his creative hand, from bees to pollen to our brains to sea turtles, Fred.
To sea turtles.
It's all there. The evidence is overwhelming that there's a creator God. What still remains is for the individual to humble himself and say, you know, if God is this brilliant, if God is this caring that he filled the earth like this for us, I should repent and I should trust in Jesus Christ who made all these things.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Fred Amazing. Williams. Hey,
Thanks,
the banquet's
Bob.
Coming up September 17th. Alan Keyes, Tom Tancredo, be there, Colorado Right to Life. Hi, this is Bob Enyart with Real Science Friday. You can get great science materials from us, DVDs, debates, books, all from our website, kgov.com, or by calling us 1-800-8-ENYARDS. So here's a list of what you can get. DVDs from Illustra Media that we carry, The Privileged Planet, Unlocking the Mystery of Life, and Darwin's Dilemma. And then there are the two fabulous DVDs from Dr. Carl Werner, on Evolution, the Grand Experiment, Living Fossils, you'll want to see those. And then Spike Passaris, formerly with the U.S. Military Space Program, What You Aren't Being Told About Astronomy. And then there's the BEL debates, Bob Debates an Evolutionist, Dr. Eugenie Scott on DVD, and a book, Does God Exist? Bob Enyart debates atheist Zaketh, a psychologist. We also have two DVDs on our seminar, Does God Exist? And then Mount St. Helens, The Explosive Evidence for Catastrophe. We also have our debate on the age of the earth, where I got to debate a mathematician from CU up in Boulder and a geophysicist on this MP3 CD. And finally, my favorite science book, In the Beginning, by Dr. Walt Brown. Just call us at 800-8-ENYARDS. 800-836-9278, or check out our online store in the science department either at kgov.com or realsciencefriday.com.